Thank you again. Anya, thank you for the very fine reflection on the solstice that we also celebrate at this time of year. Very rich and full service today. And I thank everyone who's had a part in it. One quick thing, too. Next Sunday is our New Year's Potpourri service. I'm going to be visiting family, my family in southern West Virginia for the holidays. And so Roy Goodman is going to be leading the New Year's Potpourri service, where you're invited to bring a reading or a reflection that's been especially meaningful to you over the years that you'd like to share with those who are here on that morning to expand that out a little bit. So I offer that invitation to you, as well as Anya's, to bring something this evening. It was nearly 50 years ago that the Reverend Jack Mendelson came out with a book largely intended for his fellow UUs called Being Liberal in an Illiberal Age. Even though nearly a half a century has gone by since his publication, the title is no less timely. While Jack, now long into retirement, was a pretty strong political activist, the book itself has very little, if any, political content. He's writing about liberal religion. And towards the end of a chapter on the meaning of the person of Jesus in the liberal tradition, Jack writes, "To me, the important thing about Jesus is not that he was just human, but that the human race is capable of producing him. And not just him alone, but others like him. And not only in ancient times, but now." I recall Jack's words as I set out to prepare this third installment on my holiday trilogy that I've been doing here for December of 2010. Over the past couple of Sundays, we've been looking at the place of myth and legend and fantasy when it comes to matters of belief. I led this series off back on December the 5th by agreeing with the president of our UU Association, the Reverend Peter Morales, where in one of his sermons he maintains that a narrowly prescribed belief system actually chokes off what he and I also call a universal religious impulse. The impulse, that is to say, to reach beyond ourselves and beyond our time-bound existence for some greater and higher meaning or purpose in our lives. And then on last Sunday, those of you here will recall, on the 12th, with some help from Joseph Campbell and Carl Jung, we focused more closely on how storytelling and the weaving of myths and legends are among the ways human beings over the ages, one of the ways human beings over the ages have responded to this religious impulse. And so this morning, we're going to narrow it down even a little more and focus on one particular myth and legend, the one about the birth of Jesus, and that will wrap up these three past Sundays, and be a quiz during coffee hour on all three. No. To go back to Mendelson for a moment, at first read, he seems to be saying that the accounts of the life of Jesus, his birth, life, and death, were simply made up by human beings out of whole cloth. But that's not a quite accurate reading of his words. His assertion is not a dismissal of Jesus. Rather, it is a statement of hope about the human race. His point, which echoes Joseph Campbell's warning about not getting trapped in the metaphor, is not yet too terribly hung up on quote-unquote what really happened, but focus instead on the positive fact that humanity is capable of putting forth persons or images of persons who exemplify the best in humanity, both in ancient times as well as today. What Jack is saying is that he takes hope in just the very fact that human beings are capable of imagining, or at least trying to follow the example of a person like Jesus, whoever he may have actually been. Well, Reverend Mendelson is hardly the first UU minister to make this point. One of our Unitarian forebears of nearly 160 years ago, the Reverend Theodore Parker, said close to the same thing in an ordination sermon he delivered in 1841 called The Permanent and the Transient in Christianity. I would say, to the extent that we UUs have a canon, this sermon of Parker's is part of it. It is one of the foundational documents in our Unitarian Universalist story. And Parker's point, clear back in the 1840s, was that the permanent aspects of Christianity are the eternal truths and the ethical imperatives that are contained within it, and which also find their expression in many of the other world's religions as well. These are the truths and the imperatives of love and peace, justice, and healing within humanity, along with the call to set at liberty those who are oppressed, as Jesus put it in a sermon ascribed to him. That's the permanent, according to Parker. The transient, again according to Parker, were and are the temporary, time-bound, earthly vehicles that conveyed or embodied these eternal truths and these moral and ethical challenges. And so the person of Jesus and the doctrines that were later set forth in his name were and are transient vehicles that point us towards the eternal, towards the universal, towards the permanent. Well, I would imagine that his stance today is pretty ho-hum for a Unitarian Universalist. I doubt there's any strong disagreement with any of that. But Parker paid a price for these views in the 1840s and the 1850s. This was the same time during which he was also very active in the abolitionist movement, to the point of helping raise money to fund John Brown's raid on the federal arsenal in Harper's Ferry, Virginia, now West Virginia. Parker was not a strict apostle of nonviolence. And so between his radical political activities, and even for the Unitarians of his day, his radical religious views, he was largely ostracized from the Unitarian clergy in the Boston area where he lived. He nonetheless did gather, largely on the strength of his personality and his eloquent oratory, a very large congregation in West Roxbury, Massachusetts, in the middle of the 19th century. And there's a twist to Parker's idea that I just put out there that brings me back to my sermon topic. And that is that those permanent and timeless truths and moral principles of which Parker spoke do us very little good and scarcely serve us at all if they only exist in the abstract. And Parker, who considered himself a Christian in the sense of being a follower of Jesus, would have agreed with that, since the person and the example of Jesus was very important to him. So it is then that over the course of human history, we human beings have produced persons who serve that purpose for us. Those persons who demonstrate for us how humanity at its best would look and behave. Some of these persons are identifiable historical figures. Some of them are not. Some of them, perhaps most of them, are a mixture of history and biography and legend and mythology. And to say that we make these figures up out of nothing, and therefore they have no meaning to us, to say that, which those Freedom from Religious Foundation ads I referred to a couple of Sundays ago seem to imply, I find that very simplistic and dishonest. We produce our mythic heroes and heroines out of certain available material about them, adding in what we need to see in them. And that's not really a bad thing. Recall Mendelssohn once again. The important thing about Jesus is not that he was just human, but that the human race is capable of producing him. To some of these idealized human beings we produce, we even give them super or suprahuman qualities, to the point of seeing them as gods or quasi-gods. In the Greco-Roman world, into which Jesus was born and lived, there was nothing especially unusual about the union of a god and an earthly mortal to produce an extraordinary individual with godlike qualities. In the worldview of that time, Egyptian, Greek, and Roman gods and goddesses cohabited with earthly mortals quite frequently, probably quite joyfully, to produce extraordinary earthly mortals. So for the first century church, to maintain that Jesus was the result of the union of God and a young woman was actually quite consistent with the worldview of that time and place. And this points to the problem that biblical literalists create for themselves. They try to shoehorn a first century mentality and worldview into a 21st century worldview and mentality, and that leaves them having to believe some pretty weird things. But we're going to leave all that be because I got other ground to cover here. the story of Jesus, including the accounts of his miraculous, by our standards, birth, is one such story that human beings have told over the course of history as a way of keeping us believing in ourselves and in who or what, and in who or what we might yet become. So let's spend a bit of time with the story itself, which we will hear read once again this Friday evening at our Christmas Eve services. And in so doing, let us remind ourselves once again, drawing upon the message of the past two Sundays, that mythology, as we are using the term now, is not the same as falsehood. Mythology, in its truest sense, is a timeless collection of stories about who we are, or who we want to be as human beings, and not a recording of historical events. So what I see in the stories of the birth of Jesus, as told in the biblical Gospels of Luke and Matthew, there are none in the Gospels of Mark and John, is a depiction of the fragility and the vulnerability of being human on the one hand, and an assurance of the power of human possibility and the power of the human spirit on the other. Consider all that's contained in that image of the infant Jesus. A homeless baby in a makeshift shelter, probably not all that different from the circumstances that we're in that I read in the children's story a little earlier today. Baby is probably scared, baby hungry, in need of care and nurture and love. All due respect to Martin Luther and his best known hymn, Away in a Manger, I question that line about no crying he makes. Anybody who's ever raised a kid would do that too. I bet the little fella bawled his lungs out at times. On some visceral level, on the level of our personal unconscious that we explored last Sunday with some help from Carl Jung, this image of a vulnerable and probably frightened baby can, if we let it speak to us, can put us in touch with some of our own neediness, some of our own loneliness, with the many vulnerabilities we each and all carry around with us. We've all been there at one time or another with our neediness, with our vulnerability. Maybe it helps to have a story to remind us that we've been there. Maybe that's why we have produced this one. But the hinge, there's a twist upon which this story myth turns, and that is that this same needy and vulnerable and seemingly helpless piece of humanity just happens to possess the very qualities that will save humanity. And I think we need to know that too. When we sometimes look at ourselves and the world in which we have to live our lives, which after all is the only world we've got, we can easily wonder, what possible difference can I make? What can I possibly offer that will bring some greater measure of peace and justice and healing to a world so desperately in need of these things? It can make us feel rather small and helpless when we confront such questions as these. But the other piece of the story is that this same helpless baby also embodies the hope and the promise and the possibility that we see in every newborn. This is why the Reverend Sophia Foss, who is recognized as the mother founder of today's Unitarian Universalist religious education, this is why she could say in that well-known and oft-quoted poem of hers, every night a child is born is a holy night. The story continues then, that this same helpless-looking human being grew up to exemplify the best that was in human beings as he traveled through the world of his day, identifying with the lowly and the dispossessed of his day, proclaiming that we're all cared about and loved and deserve to live in a world of peace and justice, that all of our lives count, that they all have their own worth and dignity. And he proclaimed all of that in the name of a God whom he called Father. But the deeper part of Jesus' message, as our own Theodore Parker and others came to see, lies well beyond the theological package in which it came to be wrapped, as well as well beyond the theological baggage that came to be attached to it. The humanistic angle which I see in the Jesus narrative is that we too possess within us the resources, the power, and the strength of the human spirit to grow up and grow beyond our occasional feelings of helplessness and exemplify in our lives the better, if not the best, qualities of human living. I know it takes a certain amount of faith to believe that. It sure does for me. But it's a faith worth having. And this, I feel, is why this story has been produced and why it continues to be told. Well, let me offer just one more take on it then, before I close as I wrap this series up. Another piece of insight I gained from the story myth of a baby through whom God arrives is an affirmation of the power and the potentiality of human life. For all the disagreements that I came to have with Christian theology, which were enough to eventually get me into the UU camp and the UU ministry, I still find it very intriguing that at the heart of Christian theology is the story or the myth of a God who arrives not as a supernatural force, but rather simply as a human being who spent his life trying to show other human beings how to be more authentically human. Like some Christians have gotten that, others have not. Be that as it may. So what this God-child metaphor suggests to me as a religious humanist is that all I need when it comes to finding meaning and purpose and depth and power and relatedness in my life has already been given to me. I still, even in my seventh decade of living, may not have opened up the whole package of possibility yet, but I think it's still there. The story or the myth of a child in whom God arrives is simply arrives simply as another traveler on our common human way is both a simple and profound message all at the same time. For it reminds us that all we need for our personal and shared journeys is here. And we can get up and move. The story of a child who embodies all the qualities of the highest also recalls the words of late Joseph Campbell in those conversations with Bill Moyers that we revisited last Sunday. Campbell said, "All the gods, all the heavens, all the worlds are within us." And that in a nutshell is why we have created the kinds of stories that lie at the heart of many, if not all, the world's religious traditions, including the one we're looking at this morning. It's because we need a way of getting those gods, those heavens, those worlds, as Campbell called them, a way of getting those gods, those heavens, those worlds that are within us out where we can see them and can grasp their true message. What I've shared this morning, what we have celebrated this morning in this whole service, is one of those stories. It contains a message that transcends the faith in which it is rooted. It is a story that we human beings have shaped and created in the best sense of those terms. It is a story we have produced to remind us of who, at our best, we are, and what we, at our best, may yet become. So let's revisit it one more time. We'll sing our closing hymn. It's number 228, Once in Royal David's Cathedral.